Issues Regarding Faith, Reason, Truth, Postmodernism, and the Bible was presented by Jack Crabtree on August 15, 2003 at Gutenberg College's Summer Institute, Postmodernism, Reason, and the Church. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2003. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. The following recording has a brief break in the middle and the loss of some teaching at the end. These are the result of the original 60-minute tape switching to the second side and running out before the end of the teaching.
Okay, what I hope to do here is to try to see if we can tie everything together as best we can. So what I want to do here is to just provoke the questions or the topics or the concerns that we can then talk about to bring those threads together in the question and answers as coming up. So let me do by just trying to do a little start by doing a little thought experiment here. What I tried to do, remember I made a distinction yesterday between postmodernism as a descriptor of just the culture and the forces in the culture around us today, as opposed to the postmodernism that is a particular kind of philosophical stance toward knowledge and truth and reality and that kind of thing. And that gets confusing because we talk back and forth between the two, and sometimes what we call postmodernism is just some of the stuff that's happening because of technology and technological advancement and cultural change that's going on in the world today, and we can call that postmodernism if we want to, but is there a link between that and this philosophical perspective? Well, sometimes that's harder to see. At least for me, it's harder to see. So we can go wherever you want to go with that, but I just think as we talk with each other, if we make a distinction between, it'll help people like me who want to know, why are you calling that postmodernism? What exactly, at what level you're speaking. But taking not postmodernism, broadly speaking, but in the more narrow sense of what's going on philosophically in the world today, I tried to ask myself the question, what would it look like for the Christian church, the Christian culture, to have accepted some of the premises, some of the perspectives of postmodernist philosophy? What would we expect to see? And I just kind of brainstormed a number of different things here. And then the next question I asked myself is, so do I see that in the church today? What seems to be going on in Christian culture? And let me just lay that out, that thought experiment out for you. You can add to it in our discussion later, because I'm sure I don't have everything, and you'll have a different take on what's going on in Christian culture. And I think just by comparing notes on that, we can come to a greater understanding of whether there has been or has not been an impact of postmodernism on the church today. Okay, here's my list. If a Christian culture had imbibed postmodernism altogether, the bad along with the good, it seems to me that it would abandon apologetics, for one thing. It would see no need for there to be any sort of rational grounding of or defense of our faith. And hopefully that's relatively clear why, because they see rationality as simply a social construct anyway. So whether you do reason or don't do reason is sort of optional, sort of arbitrary. So I have a rational defense for my faith. Okay, that's okay for me. I have a so-called rational defense of their faith. What's the problem with that? There shouldn't really be any problem with that if you've accepted some of the elements of postmodernism. Postmodernism says we all have our meta-narrative. We all have our narrative, I should say. We all have our narrative, but there really is, in the end, no meta-narrative. There really is, in the end, no standard or basis or criteria for judging whether my narrative is any better than any other narrative. All narratives are equally valid to postmodernism, if you take it at its logical conclusion. So, why would I not do apologetics? I mean, really, not only would I abandon apologetics, I would abandon evangelism. Because there really isn't any good reason, if I accept the postmodernist view, why you should be a Christian rather than a Buddhist. Because Buddhism is one narrative, Christianity is another narrative, Islam is another narrative, secular atheism is another narrative. I mean, we all have our narratives, and can't we just respect the fact that the only thing that we have in common ultimately is we probably all need to tell ourselves some story or another in order to make sense out of reality. But which story we tell ourselves, which one we pick, that's really in the end neither here nor there. And let's stop fighting about whose story is better than whose. That would be a very, very postmodernist perspective, it seems to me. So both apologetics and evangelism would at least be downplayed, if not abandoned altogether. So what are we doing as Christians together then? The tendency is going to go toward tradition, community. What we do together is that we have just simply come together and we have our tradition, and our tradition has a narrative that it tells, has a story that it tells, and we share this narrative together. So that's what binds us together. We do the same things, we think the same way, we drink the same drinks and smoke the same smokes, and you know, that's what binds us together, is the narrative and all that follows from that. But we're not making any sort of claims about any other traditions or any other religions. Can't do that. We have no meta-narrative from which to do that. So the whole idea that Jesus is the only way would under postmodernism become oppressive at worst and something to be kind of ignored at best under postmodernism. Jesus isn't the only way. It is interesting in that regard that that's become a hot debate among evangelicals these days. So I have to confess, you know, maybe there is some inroads of postmodernism here. The fact that we would even be debating that question. I mean, it's one thing for fundamentalists and liberals to debate that years and years and years ago, but for evangelicals to be debating whether Jesus is the only way. Okay. What's going on? Another effect of that, it seems to me, that's related to that would be we would tend to downplay altogether the whole notion of doctrine. My faith is not about truth. My faith is not about knowledge. My faith and doctrine is just simply the, you know, the acceptable Christian word to use for knowledge, the knowledge claims that we subscribe to. Postmodernism has rejected the validity of knowledge and truth and ideas. Those are simply constructs, social constructs. So that can't be at the heart of what my relationship with God is all about. I mean, if it's as paper thin as a social construct, as a personal construct, then that can't surely be the substance of my relationship with God and the substance of spirituality. We can't have anything to do with it. So we have to look elsewhere for the substance of what it means for me to be in relationship to God. So doctrine, all people ever do, all Christians ever do, is fight about that anyway. Let's, for the most part, do everything we can to ignore that, and let's get to the heart and substance of what it means to be rightly related to God. Now, I'll let you fill in the blanks there, but postmodernism would just reject that. I don't know that it would dictate what you put in its place, but it would reject that. Let me just take a tangent here for a second. I don't know what your groups did with Foucault and how you put that together, but let me give you my interpretation of Foucault to try to dramatize the impact of postmodernism on something like doctrine. My take on Foucault is that he actually has a very strongly metaphysical view behind what he's saying, which is ironic that he would be so strongly a metaphysician when metaphysics should have no place whatsoever. But these guys are full of irony. I think he has a very, very clear and decisive metaphysical picture behind what he's saying. And there are just some clues in the conclusion to Madness and Civilization that I picked up on. And I may be making this up. I mean, this may be a construct of Foucault, but...
Deconstructionist?
Yeah, that's right. But I'm telling you what he really meant. There's this phrase he uses, the nothingness of unreason. The nothingness of unreason. I think his metaphysical view is, ultimate reality, when you get right down to it, what is there, what exists, what has reality? Nothing. Ultimate reality is this just blank, black nothingness with no content, no substance, no order, no structure, no nothing. And it looks to me like what he's saying is reality, as the only thing that has reality, the only thing that has existence, is what we human beings have brought into existence by ordering and structuring the nothingness. What is because we have honored something and privileged something and negated and made absent its polar opposite. And so we bring existence into the world, reality into the world, by ordering the reality. But a corollary to that is that we will always be marginalizing something. In order to have any existence at all, there must be an other. There must be something that is the opposite, the outcast, the marginalized, the downtrodden, the oppressed. That's simply one of the fallouts of there being any reality at all, is that there's going to be a underclass and an underprivileged, a non-ratified part of what we call reality. You can't have reality any other way. So, I mean, you can see what a really tragic, his metaphysics is a very tragic view of the world. The alternative, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. You can have reality, in which case you must have suffering, injustice, oppression, sorrow, grief, all the stuff that comes in the social political dynamics of history and the world that lives. They are inevitable. They couldn't be otherwise. It's the only way it can possibly go, on the one hand. What's the alternative? For there to be no reality at all. Just utter blank, black darkness. So it's very... live in his skin for a while. I mean, you're damned if you do and you're damned if you don't. But when he talks about his art, the artist is just on the fringe... First of all, insanity or the madman. What is madness? Madness is one of those ways, I don't think it's the only way for him, but one of those ways in which the nothingness, the other with a big R-O, that where the other is breaking through the paper-thin, fragile skin of reality and exposing it for the fragile, paper-thin thing that it actually is. It exists, but it exists only by the willful imposition of order by us human beings. If we didn't willfully impose order on the nothingness, then it would all get abolished. It would all be destroyed. It would all be negated and sucked back into the black hole of the nothingness that is the ultimate reality. So madness threatens. Madness exposes, madness challenges this order that we have created and shows how vulnerable this reality actually is. Any other does, madness or whatever it might be. In his case, I think he'd make the claim that homosexuality does that. So anything that is deviant, that is abnormal, that is irregular, that is atypical, threatens this order that we human beings have created. Art, then, is right on the margins of madness, is right on the boundary between madness and rationality. It's not madness because it makes sense, it has order to it, it has structure to it, but it's right on the border between madness and rationality, where the madness, the challenge and the questioning and the dissolving corrosive effects of madness can sort of leak through into our reality and pose those questions and make those challenges and threaten us in the helpful, humiliating kind of way that it can. Okay, so anyway, the point I want to make about all that is, look at what he's saying. Our knowledge, all of reality, in fact, not just our knowledge, but all of reality, all of our ideas, are just this paper-thin imposition that human beings have made on a more ultimate reality. Well, bring that into the church. Doctrine can't be very important if that's all we've done. If any knowledge is only this made-up, contrived, and not even very substantial contrived thing that we've all done, why bother with doctrine? Who cares what the Bible said? Who cares what some systematic theologian said? Who cares how you put your theology together? I mean, you can wallpaper, and you can re-wallpaper, and you can re-wallpaper, and everybody can have their own wallpaper, and it doesn't really make any difference in the end. Because that's not what it's all about. There's something more ultimate, something more real. Now, I don't think the church would go, I don't think they would buy his metaphysics, but it's the nothingness that you fall back into. But they're going to put something in its place because it can't be doctrine. Postmodernism is okay with doing knowledge as long as we recognize it's just a game. Just a thing we do. Yeah, and you play the game, and you keep reinventing new rules to play the game, and you play the game differently next week from the way you played it this week, and you can be creative and reinvent the game anytime you want to. Well, what kind of impact would that have on it? To the extent that we take knowledge at all seriously, it seems like Bible study, doctrine, theology, even moral reasoning is going to remain just an intellectual game that we're doing with each other as Christians. In this Christian community, this is the game we play. Charlie was pointing out to me the affinities between postmodernism and another earlier philosopher named Ludwig Wittgenstein. And I hadn't really even noticed the connection, but it's true. It's some striking similarities. One of the terms that Wittgenstein used was language game. And his contention is that every use of language is simply a language game. And I won't talk about all the implications of that, but I mean, it's just striking that he uses that language. I don't think it's an accident. You know, I think one of the things he intended in that label is to sort of trivialize the importance of our conversations and our dialogue with one another, the arbitrariness of it, the lack of substance to it, the lack of seriousness of it. In the end, it's just a game. Some people might interpret him differently to mean that he didn't mean that, but I think he did. I think that's probably part of why he picked that language. It's not a sober quest for truth. It's just an arbitrary social interaction that we do with language. When you look at postmodernism, Derrida, for example, and his understanding of language, the theory of language that he has, bring that into the church. We've got our Bibles. We're supposedly reading our Bibles. This is our text. This is the text of text for us. But what is text? It's fluid. It's malleable. There's no definitive meaning to it. This difference that, how do you pronounce it? Difference? Just that absent, I'll make it one syllable, right? Difference. That you're constantly deferring the meaning. You never really know what it means, so somebody else can keep coming along and finding some new aspect or some new nuance to this word, to this theological category, to this biblical idea. We're always going to be finding new meanings, new ideas, new import to it, new inferences to it. So nothing will ever be settled, nothing will ever be known, nothing will ever be established. We just keep floating along, bouncing ourselves off the Bible, and whatever comes. So Bible study is going to be literally, well, what does this mean to you today? And that would be perfectly understandable in a postmodern context. I think this would be linked to postmodernism. that our church culture then, it seems to me, would be very, very inclined to follow fads and fashion. Theological fashion, spiritual fashion, institutional fads, you know, because under postmodernism there is no reality, there's nothing fixed, so you are actually continually having to reinvent reality. So if you're continually reinventing reality, well, the way it was today is not necessarily the way it will have to be or needs to be tomorrow, and so we take a fresh look at it and we reorder, restructure, reinvent how we do church and who we are as a Christian community and what the gospel is and who God is and so on. So Cavalis, they had a big seminar on re-envisioning God or reinventing God or visioning God for the 21st century or something like that. We will tend, I think, if we imbibe postmodernism, to be morally tolerant, because moral values, just like anything else, are a social construct. And just like the narrative that we tell ourselves, there's no one narrative that is better than any other narrative. There's no set of moral principles that's any better than the next one. Morality is just a contrivance. And it's a contrivance for postmodernism that people use to manipulate other people. So what we ought to do is back off, not take our morality too seriously, recognize it's a contrivance, and if somebody else wants to live by a different set of moral rules, that's equally valid, that's okay. And we had, just this last week, the Episcopal Church vote an open, self-confessed homosexual as a bishop in the Episcopal Church. I think that's the end of my list. Those are things that derive, I think, in my mind, directly from kind of the philosophy of postmodernism. A couple of other things came to mind that seem to come out of the culture, the larger culture of postmodernism. Let me comment on those. Given our modern or postmodern culture, it would tend to focus, I think, on addressing people's felt needs. That is, it's going to take its cues from what do you want? Here I'm a church, we're the Christian community. Tell me what you want and we'll address it. Tell me what you feel like you need for yourself, and let us as a Christian community give you that and supply that to you. I don't know that that's connected to the philosophy of postmodernism in any way, but it certainly is very much the culture that our world is in today. And because of the emphasis on relationship, and maybe this is connected to the philosophy of postmodernism, I'm not sure, I'm not as convinced, but I think there will be a tendency to reduce the Christian message to love one another. Come on, people, get together and love one another. I'll just leave it at that. We can talk about that. But I did miss one on the other one. Imbibing postmodernism would make a tendency to do our theology, to the extent that we do theology, it would turn it into a political process. We do theology by politics, by power politics. We do moral reasoning, morality, by power politics. So in our churches, I think we would increasingly expect to see the way we make doctrinal decisions is I get enough people to sign a petition or join together with me to kick the bums out, or you know, vote for this doctrine rather than this other doctrine. Okay. Well, the thing that's striking to me after when I do this experiment, and you guys can add stuff to that if you want. The thing that struck me is how, from my childhood, I see every one of these tendencies, or virtually every one of these tendencies, in the Christian culture that I grew up in. When I was in grade school, I was hearing some of the church leaders saying, doctrine divides. You need to avoid doctrine. You need to stay away from doctrine. Let's just love Jesus. our faith is about relating to Jesus and instead having a relationship with Jesus. That's what our faith is all about. So we need to consciously and deliberately reject and avoid doctrine. That goes way, way back in my experience. Probably not so much the Jesus is the only way, at least in my experience. That was pretty much a given in conservative Christian circles. So to the extent that we are kicking that around, that is new, I will acknowledge. A rational defense for our faith? My whole life, there were two kinds of people in the church. There are those people who responded very positively to having their faith grounded rationally in arguments and evidences that made it intellectually, allowed them to have faith with intellectual integrity. But then there was a much, much larger component of the Christian culture I grew up with that would said, well, why do you need that? I mean, just, he's in your heart. I mean, Jesus is in your heart. What more do you need? You don't need an argument. You don't need evidence. You don't need, it doesn't have to be rational. It's just, there's a much more immediate connection you have with the reality of your faith that doesn't need to be mediated by any kind of rationality, any kind of arguments. And I'd say there are more people like that in my background than people who accepted the need for a rational grounding. Bible study, for as long as I can remember, we were doing Bible studies by what does this mean to you? It was totally, totally a foreign concept that we would actually be needing to come to some kind of objective meaning in the text that we would all be answerable to. I had to struggle through and find my way there pretty much by myself with not a whole lot of help, because everywhere I would go, they would validate the idea that what the text means to you might be different than what it means to somebody else. And that seemed to be long before anybody had ever heard of Derrida or Foucault. The fact that the biblical text would be seen, its meaning would be seen as fluid and changing, was a part of that picture as well. You'd have people give a testimony about their Bible study, about how they would be looking at the text in one way, and then they'd come back later in their quiet time and they'd read the text in another way, and they had been blessed with a new insight and a new truth this time through. And not that there can't be some truth to that. I mean, there's a way in which you can understand how that could be true, but I don't think that's what they meant. You know, what they meant was the text is a catalyst to some kind of personal, subjective insight. It didn't have any meaning. It was only a catalyst to me discovering meaning, which was a very, very different way of looking at the Bible than I think is right. The following of fads, I think, is relatively new in my experience, because the church I grew up in with was very hidebound and traditional and stuck and unwilling to be innovative and stuff like that. But from the 60s on, it seems to me the church has been nothing but a recycling through one fad, one fashion after another. This year, it's prayer. You know, we just need to learn how to do prayer right. And so every church has a prayer conference and an emphasis on teaching our people how to pray and so on and so forth. And the next year it's evangelism, and in the next year it's discipleship, and the next year it's this, and the next year it's that. And we're just constantly moving, shifting, changing our ground. This year we finally struck on the key to real spiritual vitality in our community. Moral tolerance, that's new. And maybe not even be making an impact yet on conservative Christian culture, although it would be very interesting to take some, not polls, I don't know how much they could show, but to get into some conversations with the people in Bible-believing conservative evangelical churches and just kind of feel out their attitudes towards something like homosexuality, for example, or maybe some other, you know, kind of more out there in the culture moral issue, and see what kind of impact this stuff has had on them. I think it may be true that we would see some softening in their perspective on morality. So I'm just going to pose this as a question to you, because I don't have the answer to it. how much of what we have seen in the Christian culture is a result of the impact of postmodernist ideas and elements of their philosophy, and how much of it has just come about independent of that, for other reasons, for other philosophical reasons, for maybe very human reasons. Maybe sin always goes this direction in a certain sense. I don't know. But what's striking to me is how much what I would anticipate to be the effects of postmodernist philosophy has actually been there for decades within American Christendom. But what started me thinking is my conversation at lunchtime with Charlie. Even though Derrida and Foucault have not been household names since before the 60s or 70s, Wittgenstein was, Nietzsche was, American pragmatism, people like William James have been. And even though they're not postmodernists, strictly speaking, they share a lot in common. There's a lot of common ground when it comes to their view of reality and truth and knowledge and so on. There's a lot of common ground with them. So maybe the foundations for the philosophy of postmodernism has been washing over our shores for actually over a century. And so maybe that has had its impact in a way that I haven't really paid any attention to. All the other miscellaneous comments that I was going to make, I think, have one way or the other in question answers or whatever come out. There's some stuff I'm just skipping over here, but I think it would be good to just go into a dialogue now, into a discussion, and I'd like your input, your observations. What do you see as the relationship between Christian culture and postmodernism? Let's help each other pull this stuff together. I mean, I'd like to accomplish two things here. One, help me understand better. Let's help one another understand better. The major focus of this time, and that is the effect of postmodernism on Christian culture. And then secondly, any loose ends that you feel from your discussions, let's see if we can tie them up.
In response to what you just asked, I think the rational defense of the faith being optional, I don't really see that as much from postmodernism as it's maybe laziness too. It's easier not to have to defend it and go through that. And also how uncomfortable it is in a church situation in community to have conflict all the time and just rather be without conflict and laziness too, instead of maybe postmodernism.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. So you're saying maybe ultimately the root of that is just a human problem of the laziness that comes out of not taking intellectual integrity seriously enough. Okay. Yeah, I'm very sympathetic to that. That could very well be true.
Would you say that affirmative action is a good example of a deconstruction part of postmodernism?
How so?
Basically on saying that you need that affirmative action is needed for diversity, things like that. And talk about of how the reconstruction aspect of postmodernism. Yet during lunch, I sort of thought that there was a link between that.
Okay. Well, here's a link I see. I'm not sure if I'm directly answering your question. But here's a link I see. I gave this example in some of my groups, but I was preaching a sermon once at another church as a visiting teacher, and I was trying to make some point about eternal life versus in the doctrine of rewards that a lot of people buy into. There's eternal life, but that's really no big deal because everybody who makes it to the kingdom of God is going to have that. What's really the big deal are these rewards that we're going to get if we do our life down here right. If we do it the right way, we're going to store up all kinds of rewards for ourselves. And that's what's really hot in the kingdom of God, are the rewards, not eternal life. And I was trying to make the point that's really to misunderstand the biblical perspective, because in the biblical perspective, eternal life is what it is. That's where it's at. That's what's hot. And so the way I described the kind of denigration of eternal life that other doctrine has, as I talked about, I just used the phrase, we could have plain old vanilla eternal life, or this other thing. Well, after the message, this black woman came up to me and said, "You really ought not to use that phrase, plain old vanilla, in describing that, because what you have done is you have reinforced the notion that white and everything white and white culture is normative, and therefore blacks are abnormal and subnormal somehow, and you have just reinforced that." Well, she was doing a strict deconstruction on my message there, because it had nothing to do with the surface level of what I was saying, had nothing to do with the point that I was making, but she was saying the unconscious effect of your using that particular phrase is to reinforce racism in American culture. So affirmative action is an attempt to address the injustice of racism in this culture, and they do see our institutions, things like the number of faculty members who are of different groups and so on, as being different ways in which we are reinforcing attitudes, reinforcing perspectives and visions on reality, and therefore the only way to change the beliefs and the attitudes is to change our institutions or change our language, change what we say in sermons and that kind of thing. So I think there is a link between them. Deconstruction, strictly speaking, is only something you do to a text. But I see the connection you're making. I think that's right.
When you were talking about we bring reality into the world by ordering the reality, and then you're saying that the corollary is that you'll always be marginalizing and there's a fallout of there being a reality at all, and you're saying there's a tragedy that you have the lower class and depression. Where within that is I was going to phrase it, what is the base view of man that these philosophers are taking on? And compares to be like Pope's belief that man is inherently good, and then you build up from that. Is there any base view of the nature of man being inherently evil or inherently good?
I think their base view of man is he's inherently he has a will to, in Foucault's case, to make something out of nothing, and that's a parallel to Nietzsche's will to power. He wants to take control, and so that he doesn't get swallowed up in nothingness, he needs to take control, and that's his exertion of power. And I think their view is that every human being is going to just sort of instinctively, naturally, normally, I mean, they can't even use words like naturally, but just is a agent of power.
So they've reduced it to a base instinct, and whether or not that's good or bad, it doesn't matter.
Yeah, they have no position to make any value judgment on that. Yeah.
As you were asking the question, Jack, about just you were talking about the things that you think you see, and when you said, "I do see all these things," and even from my my childhood, and I think I agree with that. And my question to you back would be, what about the ecumenical movement? And it seems like the ecumenical movement is based on, hey, let's all get together, let's love each other. And that seems like it started back in the
50s, yeah.
With certain players.
Mm-hmm.
Billy Graham, for one, maybe. Anyway, is ecumenicism rooted in this, or did it come about? I guess I'm just sort of firing the question back.
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, I guess that is my question. Does it have some other source? Does it have some other cause? It clearly has behind it a kind of downplaying of the importance of theological distinctives and therefore of theology, I think. I mean, there's a right kind of ecumenism, and that is, say this theology is true, you say this other theology that's true, that's mutually contradictory, but we can still respect the fact that we're if it's true, assuming it's true, we can still both respect the fact that we're trying to figure this thing out. We just, at this point in time in our journey, aren't on the same page exactly in every respect. But I could still, it's not, they're right that right theology, good theology, is not what makes us children of God. What makes us children of God is that we have a sound heart, that we're being sanctified by the Spirit of God, that the Spirit of truth is at work in us to get us to see what my existence is all about and to have centered my life in the purposes of God in my existence. And I'm seeking now, having centered my life there, to understand better, more accurately, more clearly what all that entails and what all is the background for that in the world, in what background worldview lies behind that. That's what I'm in the process of doing. And we could understand that that's a lifelong task, and so at any given snapshot in our lives, we may not be on the same page in that regard. But I may very well sense that you are being sanctified by the Spirit of God, even though you have lousy theology.
Sure.
And you likewise can see that I have lousy theology, even though you are being sanctified by the Spirit of God. So we have koinonia.
Yeah.
We have fellowship with one another, but we disagree theologically. Well, that kind of ecumenism is fine. I mean, that seems to me perfectly appropriate.
But didn't it progress?
But neither of us is going to say, but whether I'm right or not in my theology, or whether you're right in your theology, is sort of irrelevant or not important. Our ecumenism is out of humility, not out of diminishing the importance of theology and doctrine. And that's different. That's a whole different basis for ecumenism. I fear that in the 50s it really was a kind of denigration of the importance of theology and doctrine. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's my sense.
I do think it may be connected to evangelism.
So it was
well,
an expedient? So.
Well, we were talking a bit about the meta-narrative of Christianity and how the author we were looking at has broken it down into these propositional statements and how deficient that is as a way of communicating the meta-narrative. And David was saying here at Gutenberg College, 4 years feels like barely enough time to really explicate that and marry it to life experience. What makes sense to me about the Billy Graham Crusades is that's exactly what's going on. Billy Graham is about nothing but some basic propositions and a spirit of charity and love, and that's what Christianity is, and has been hugely powerful in drawing a really big ecumenical community together to support and facilitate. I mean, you run an event that has 50,000 people at it, you got 200 churches that are your volunteer staff. That's how it works. And I think there's stuff about that that's really cool, but it doesn't change the fact that what may be ecumenical and not such a good idea is that we're all agreeing that the way Billy Graham is imparting the meta-narrative of Christianity is a good way to do it.
Hmm.
I'm not sure who can argue with that. I mean, I think we can argue with it, but I think it's just still, it's interesting, and it may be an example of ecumenism.
I'm not sure what you mean.
Well,
sure.
Basically, I guess what I've heard is, you know, in my own, what I call my conversion experience, is it makes more sense that it's been a long process. It wasn't the stake in the ground kind of experience. But I always hear people saying, well, you know, God can use any means in any ways, and there are certain people that have conversions that are night and day. I mean, we could look at that some more, and actually, I'd be interested to look more at evangelism in general, because there's certainly some sort of values underneath what we think is the reason to evangelize.
Mm-hmm.
And this week has brought up some big beefs for me about that. I wanted to say my other contribution to whether or not something's postmodern or not. I've wondered about just people being literate. It was a big surprise to me in college to learn that in the Middle Ages, no one in the general populace could read, that only the clergy had the ability to read and write. And I may be wrong about that, but in general, it seemed like there's a clear example where literally the priests have the power of language and how a lot of people
communicate. Well, actually, there were a lot of illiterate priests, too. It was the academics who were literate.
Well, basically, what I wonder is,
what kind of a phenomenon is it today that there's still pretty widespread illiteracy, whether that's because we don't use words, we use images and TV, or the fact is there are lots, it sounds like, of instances where people are making their way through formal education and they can't read. So what kind of a contribution...
And do you mean that by that, even if they can decode the words, they're...
Okay, sure. What their critical thinking skills. I was talking about that basically...
Not even decoding.
Yeah. Okay. And it's not an excuse. It doesn't mean that we don't have the reasoning faculties to do it. But the fact that in the history of culture, there's generally been an exclusive community that's relatively small that interacts with language and concepts at the level of sophistication that we're doing. Hmm. I mean, that's even true in Eugene. And I'm trying to make sense of the fact that I live in a mill town of people that need to go to work to support their families. They didn't go to college. And what's up with that and how they conclude how much they can or cannot know or understand about the Bible, for instance, why they don't study it. Is that different than a postmodern conclusion that we can't know it,
okay,
as opposed to the practical realities of their life,
okay,
on this earth?
Yeah, good point.
This is going along with the issue of the downplaying of doctrine. If you walk into a bookstore, and this is one of my pet peeves because I frequent bookstores a lot, but you go in there and you look at the Christianity section and there's a gigantic part of it devoted to Christian inspiration, but some of the great old authors, like, I don't know, Thomas Brooks, or like some of the old works from Geneva, something like that, they're out of print. You can't find them. You have to order them, or you have to, I mean, there are some places they're less accessible than they used to be.
Mm-hmm. On the Billy Graham thing, I think that part of that is on why the ecumenical thing of Billy Graham is we, part of it is the message that we now believe we need to portray. I don't think Billy Graham's trying to get propositions out there. I don't think that's the point of Billy Graham. I think the point of Billy Graham is to get someone to have that heart experience of making a decision for Christ. And that's really what it's all about, according to him. But the way Luther, for example, would do evangelism, he was truly trying to get some propositions out there. He wanted a mass, get out propositions to the masses. This was a different way,
mm-hmm,
of doing it. He was, in other words, Luther wasn't trying to export his feeling in the castle at Wittenberg. He had just some wonderful feeling come across when he read Romans 17. He wasn't trying to export. He never talked about that hardly.
Hmm.
He just wanted to say, okay, sola gratia, sola fide, I want to get these propositions out. Hmm. A different way of doing things.
And I assume you'd vote for Luther over Billy Graham in that regard. Right?
Good guy.
Okay. No, that's true. Because Luther does not omit the existential connection with those propositions, that there must be a decision, there must be a choice. I assume that's right. That's why I would read him. You're not just giving empty intellectual assent to these propositions, you're giving a life assent to these propositions, and that's what he's after. But you have to put the propositions out there for people to make the decision whether they embrace them or not. Whereas my sense with someone like Billy Graham is that the propositional content that he's asking them to respond to is so thin. It is so not getting to the heart of what this is really all about, that they're asking them to make an existential decision without there being any content to the existential decision. You just make a decision. And I think that's why, I mean, I think statistically, a lot of people that are converted at Billy Graham Crusades are not converted to Christianity. They don't remain Christians in any meaningful sense. Would you agree, or am I getting something wrong?
Well, for Luther, the faith would be something that just happened when you preached it.
Right, by the activity of God.
By the activity of God, the invisible activity is just going to happen. But he wasn't pushing for anyone to do something. You know, come down.
Right.
Come down out of the stadium.
I got you.
That's totally foreign to that kind of thought.
Yeah, absolutely. I see what you're saying. Certainly the message that I got in my childhood, that being born again was describing an experience that you had. I think what Jesus meant by being born again, he's describing a transformation that takes place. It's not an experience that you have. It could be a transformation that happens so subtly and so slowly and gradually that you can't possibly locate it in time. But you wake up one day and you used to be allergic to God and a hater of God, and now you love God. You are an entirely new person, an entirely different person now. Whereas within the 20th century of evangelicalism, somewhere crept into our thinking that the only way to be converted is through an experience. Well, I think it probably goes back to Finney, because Finney tried to create experiences that he considered to be an aid to the Spirit of God working in their life. So an experience of weeping, an experience of what we call conviction, being convicted of my guilt, an experience where I feel the love of God. I mean, there could be any different flavors of it, but there has to be some kind of really dramatic, poignant, emotional content that makes it an experience that stands out in ordinary life, and that we call our born-again experience. I've had a number of those in my life, and the more I live, the more I think that they had virtually nothing to do with my being born again.
Well, it seems to me that, I don't know how much we want to talk about Billy Graham here, but one of the things that generation
is easier to read
responding to is kind of, I'm thinking about, like, there was a dead orthodoxy in the country at the time, and I think that there is a sense in which the propositions were available to people. And I know that for my parents' generation, for my mother and my grandmother in particular, they were so thrilled about Billy Graham because he was someone saying, make this about a choice, rather than, I mean, kind of Kierkegaardian in a way, in the sense of, you guys have heard all this all your whole life, you know, you've been in church your whole life, have you ever really understood who Jesus is and made a decision?
Mm-hmm.
I do hear some stories of conversions that happen at night and day, and that I wouldn't put it past God to work that way, even though, you know, in my experience in reality, things tend to happen more gradually to be real change. But when I think about Saul becoming Paul, I mean, he had a lot of the biblical knowledge before he encountered Jesus on the road, and that would be quite an experience, and it seemed to be a pretty quick turnaround.
Yeah, it was, but even there, as I taught through the book of Exodus.
I wasn't in town.
A little while back.
When
the thing that struck me about that thing is, I'm not sure he was converted on the road. I think he was converted several days later, only when Ananias came to him and confronted him.
Still blind.
And I can't remember now the clues in the text, but as I thought about that, it seems to me that he spent several days there in turmoil and 14 more years figuring it out.
That is a good point.
It is true that people have these instantaneous conversions, but what are they converting from and to? I mean, like, if you're a Hell's Angel and you go into an Assembly of God church and you get saved, that the transformation is from, what kind of life, how would you characterize their lifestyle? A Nietzschean lifestyle to a theistic worldview. But are they children of God yet? They've changed paradigms. They've adopted a whole new paradigm, which makes their life radically, radically different, obviously. But do they believe yet? That's not decided yet. And it's over the course of days and months. And there are a lot of people who make that conversion experience who never come to believe. They just remain Assembly of God people. But they never come to believe.
Is it maybe a pitfall then to hang on to some of these touchstone moments, like you said, maybe some of your experiences of weeping or things, and give them too much credit? Is that what you're wary of?
Well, yeah, but I mean, I don't have any problem with crediting them with being significant events. Every one of those things in my life was a significant event, but to put the theological import on it, that was the watershed moment where before I wasn't saved and after I was, don't think it's that simple.
What you're saying is there's the possibility for kind of a gray area in the conversion where you're kind of saved, but not really, or
yeah, you go to levels of purgatory based on
yeah, that's what I'm talking about.
Yeah, no, I. What I'm saying is that sanctification is a process, or not only sanctification, obviously sanctification is a process, but the calling of God is a process, when God calling us to himself, and that you can't just limit it to a moment in time. It's often over a certain duration.
There's no pinpointing when you right. kind of, when your eyes were opened and you kind of started to realize that things were...
Yeah. I mean, I'm not going to dogmatically dictate that. I mean, if God wants to do it in a moment of time, he can and will, and if he did, he did. But I'm just saying, for most of us, it wasn't quite that simple, I don't think.
So this experience, this saving experience, it's not necessarily just an experience. It's not just this moment that's kind of, that comes and just hits people. So that's why there would be an objection to certain types of evangelism that try to create experience.
Right. Because if you believe it's an experience, then you're going to have altar calls and sing Just As I Am 115 times and stuff like that, because you're seeking to be a catalyst to that experience, because the experience is what's crucial. But, you know, I think this is what Doug was saying. From Luther's perspective, you lay the propositions out there, and then you let God go to work on what they're going to do with them.
Okay.
And if that takes time, it takes time.
But isn't it kind of the same thing? I mean, because isn't God going to work regardless if you just lay it out, or if you just try to make an experience?
Well, okay. Yeah. I mean, I think God did work through one of those experiences in my life, but that's because he's not proud. I mean, it's not, the trouble is, for every one of me who marched up to the front in an altar call, and it actually ended up being a significant beginning of a significant series of events that was my accepting the call of God, for every one of me, there's probably 150 people who march up to the altar, and it didn't mean nothing in the end. It wasn't there accepting
you,
the call
of God. You couldn't say the same for the tactic that Luther would use. Because I don't...
I'm not sure what you mean.
Like, he puts it out and says, God, go to work. And people look to it and they go, okay, I'm into this. Just kind of the same way.
But what in Luther's doing, there's no pretense.
Okay.
You know, you're not saying, I preached the gospel and they became Christians. You're saying, I preached the gospel, we'll see what happens.
Okay.
Whereas the evangelist is notching his belt with everyone who comes forward. He's got a record there. I mean, I'm sorry, some of you local people have heard this story, but this was a very dramatic event in my life. I was in the second grade, and it took everything in me to be able to get up the courage to go forward. And right after I did, there were these two twin girls about my same age who also came up with me. And it was a big deal to me that I had responded to this evangelist. He was a traveling evangelist. This was a revival week kind of thing. And after we stopped the Just As I Am singing, and it was just we were up there and him, he wanted to fill out these cards on us. So he wanted name, address, you know, phone number, stuff like that. These two little girls were absolutely, completely petrified. They were so petrified, they couldn't make any sounds. They couldn't talk. And so he was trying to ask them their name and their address, and they wouldn't give it to him. They couldn't give it to him. They couldn't talk. And he got incredibly impatient with them. And this was a very poignant moment, because I thought I had just responded to the call of God, the God of the universe, and by this man, this evangelist. And I couldn't articulate it at the time, but the total incongruity of me having made the decision that I had made and this guy getting impatient just because they're too afraid and can't answer his questions was just as jarring. Whoa. it was this inarticulate, wow, what's with this? This is weird. And that was etched on my memory. And so I've always recognized the possibility of insincerity and hypocrisy and fraud among the so-called people of God and leaders who are evangelists and stuff like that, because I saw it very directly firsthand up there. You know, if he had just proclaimed the gospel to us and left it to us to, you know, and basically said to us, stick that in your pipe and smoke it and decide whether you're going to go with this or not, then he's not pretending that he's converted anybody. Oh, yeah, it was the card thing. I mean, why was he wanting to fill out these cards? Because that was the stuff that he took to his supporters and whatever. I mean, that was his proof that he was being used by God to change the lives of masses. Well, using Luther's philosophy, you're not counting scalps, you're not taking in cards, you're not making notches on your belt, you're just letting God do what God's going to do, and you're being merely a servant of the Word of God.
Wouldn't there be a different perspective then that in what you see calling as, it's more, in the case of someone who has a perspective more like Luther's, it's your gift, it's just what you do, it is how you know God through the process of doing what you do, which is teaching, maybe, I don't know if I'm making any sense, whereas a more evangelical approach would see it as their gift to God, their...
Yeah.
I don't know if I'm making a jump here, but...
This is what they are doing for God.
It is what they're doing for God, and so it's much more important that I have something to show for it.
Right.
And I don't know. It just seems to be such a huge difference in how you come to it, and
yeah.
So then it would work its way out in how it's received. And, you know, a guy who's angry because he can't get your number is really different than someone that's just delighted because they got to be a part of someone's process of knowing God. I mean,
exactly.
What better gift is there?
So yeah, exactly.
An interesting thing.
Yeah, well said.
I don't really have a question, but you're finally talking about something that I know a lot about.
Finally? Oh, okay.
Finally! It's all week! The other time I'm like, what are they talking about? We've been heavily involved in what you're talking about. And my family,
right.
Liana, my dad, what?
Yeah.
Anyway. Okay, I raised you all that way. Okay. Anyway, I mean, I've been to the full gospel realm where Kenneth Hagin, Kenneth Copeland, all those guys, Faith Healers, okay? And then we went from there to the Harvest Crusades thing. And I've met some of these people. I mean, you know, Franklin Graham. And I've talked to Greg Laurie about his faith and all this stuff. And so all I want to say is that, you know, we went to church with a huge congregation of these people that had that experience, presumably, how they got there. I mean, I wasn't there from the inception. And I don't think the question is necessarily whether it's authentic faith or not. I mean, only God knows that. It's how productive is that in your life? What difference is it making in your life? You know, I know that as a professing Christian, I had some messed up ideas before, and it really did affect the way I lived my life. Like, I thought it was all about me. It was all, you know, I didn't pray enough. I didn't intercede enough. I didn't do it right, you know. I must not, you know, be led of the Spirit or something. And so I appreciate you bringing it up, because that's been a big thing in my life, wondering, you know, what was that all about? And so I would have to say, I think these people, you know, they come to the point of where they go forward like you did, like I did, and is someone there to catch them, to show them the way? And one of the things that didn't happen to me when it was first being explained to me as a youngster in high school was, you know, yeah, well, you just say this prayer and, you know, you get saved. But nobody was teaching me what was it all about, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it's like, I just say this little prayer and I'm going to become this new person? I don't think so. You know, and so it didn't work for me for years. You know, I struggled with that.
I know that I'm saved. What does that mean?
Yeah.
Is that good?
So I think the big crisis in our church is, you know, where are people getting their theology? Where are they getting their education? And in that kind of a church, you're not getting what we're getting now, which is line upon line. And really, you know, you were talking about, you know, how you might be inspired by the Bible. And, you know, everybody knows the story. Well, I just close my eyes, open my Bible, and went, ding, and God, you know, inspired me, you know, and that's kind of what a lot of people do live their life by, and it's just not productive.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the gospel, how Jesus talks about the parable of the sower, what kind of person do you think you would classify someone like Billy Graham?
You said the parable of the what?
Of the sower.
Oh, okay.
What do you think you would classify a person like Billy Graham or another postmodern preacher in?
Well, I can't make that determination because I don't know the man. I have no evidence to know. I mean, it comes back to what Lisa was saying, that it depends on how he lives, and I don't know. I have no idea. I have some problems with his theology and his approach to ministry, but I don't think that disqualifies you from being a child of God. Because all of us, to one extent or another, are products of our culture. That's the thing that's true about postmodernism. We are all, to one degree or another, products of our culture, products of our time, and so on. And we can have some pretty messed up theology and stories that we tell ourselves about reality, even though we have hearts that are longing to know God and are seeking God. I think that's perfectly possible. It's inevitable that that would be the case. If I were to see myself, you know, 200 years from now, look back on my theology, I might find all kinds of weird things that I believe. And I would shake my hand and go, "You believed what?" But that doesn't prevent me from being an authentic child of God. It just means that I'm blinded by the assumptions of my own time, place, and culture, my own experience, my own prejudices and stuff like that are getting in the way of me actually digging my way out and finding a more accurate truth. So could it be that Billy Graham is a product of his time and place and culture in a way that he's blinded to some misconceptions that he has, and yet he's a godly man and a child of God? Absolutely. Yeah, no question. But I don't know. I mean, I'm in no, and ultimately none of us are in a position to judge the heart of another person. That's why it's good news that God is the judge and not us.
I have an observation that we're talking about these different threads, and maybe the reading that we did in Gergen on the saturated self, I think, is kind of this picture of the cultural thing that's going on here because of the media, because of globalization, because of a lot of different influences. And then we're reading Derrida and Foucault and figuring out what postmodern philosophers are kind of doing with all that and how they're, what they're putting out there as the latest, greatest response to modernism. And I'm kind of seeing them as parallel tracks in a way. And so this kind of gets back to your question of, but all this was going on in the 60s or even before that. It seems to me like there's these two parallel things happening. One is the saturation that's the result of the industrial shift,
the what shift?
The industrial shift,
The
industrial revolution, and mass media, and the shrinking of the globe, travel-wise, all those influences. And then alongside that, influenced by it certainly, but also independent of it in some ways, are these philosophers who are, you know, reading Nietzsche and Wittgenstein and, you know, whoever, and kind of coming up with these ideas. So, I don't know, just kind of offered that as a...
And you were suggesting that there's some problems that loss of identity of the self brings, that you have some comments to make about how to deal with that and how to respond to that?
Well, I think that there's it's perhaps this cultural saturation thing that all of us can identify with, whether, you know, we've come this week and we've ever read or ever heard of Foucault before this week. We're all really familiar with the saturation that we feel by the shrinking world that we live in and all those kinds of things. And I was thinking about taking this different tack on how we've been talking about this stuff this week toward, I was comparing in my mind Tim and Corey's dance the other night on self-love, which I love, and I just find that performance hysterical, and contrasted it to Gergen's ideas about the saturated self and loss of identity and kind of who we are. It's like we have these opposite extremes of we have no idea who we are, and nobody sits down long enough to let their pain catch up with them and to figure out who they are inside their own skin. And I think that's a huge cultural problem inside and outside the church. And then we have, in response to that, we have the self-help movement, pop psychology, and all kinds of stuff over here saying, becoming completely self-absorbed with who I am and what that means and can't see out of that. And I thought that was, I think their performance is a great picture of that. So I have an interest in addressing sort of how do we as Christians respond to that and what does it mean. I mean, I work as a counselor and work with people very often who are really confronted with figuring out who they are, and that's a very live issue, and it's in the context of a culture, a society, pop psychology, all that stuff that's telling them to just, you know, be true to themselves, do what feels right without any kind of bottom line or basis in what's true or right or good. I think it's a really big question for believers, and I think Christian culture in general hasn't responded well to that. I mean, what Suzanne was saying about Christian bookstores, I mean, I'm amazed at the stuff in Christian bookstores that are offered for self-help when they have absolutely no reference to anything biblical or Christian in them. Okay, one other thing. In your discussion on Tuesday, I think it was, you were talking about ways of knowing that are other than the strict modern kind of rational. There's like this rational, and then there's this intuitive and tacit knowledge and Polanyi's contribution, which I really value. And I think that's where there can be a really helpful understanding of our emotional lives as part of our experience and our knowledge that God has given us, and God has wired us with emotions that can serve as indicator lights on a dashboard and help us navigate this life. And they're uncomfortable sometimes, and we'd rather push them away and pretend that they're not there. And that's part of our life of faith, is working with what's true about all that.
That's exactly what I do with the indicator lights on my dashboard. And it's a good analogy, because a check engine, no. I don't want to do that.
Yeah, see? But seriously, I mean, the check oil, it's like you pull over right now or your engine's going to be toasted. Or, you know, the fuel light, you can wait a while. You know, feelings can be very helpful.
Kind of going along with your first observation, something that's been stirring in me this whole week, and I think with a lot of people, and I heard David talking about it earlier, so what do we do with this postmodernism, in effect, with our beliefs? What direction do we take it? Like Dave was saying, do we try to make it our Christianity more postmodern? And I think we went over a lot of that today in our groups. But this is the biggest thing I've got out of it. It's really helped me that in this age, like more than just the philosophies that are coming through from Derrida and Foucault and Nietzsche and there's a lot of things too that are very influential to me, like probably the dawn of the internet and television. It's like mass information just thrown in people's faces, and I think a lot of people get lost in that. I was talking to Brad about it earlier, that there's just so many choices nowadays, unlimited amount of choices and knowledge, that people get easily overwhelmed, and it's easy to, that these philosophies kind of feed on that, okay, well, maybe there isn't an ultimate reality. Maybe I don't have to know everything or try to figure it out. I can just go with this and that. And I think for me, as Christians, like, we feel these same feelings. We grew up in this environment. We feel these same feelings, and we're really influenced by it. I think that instead of trying to make Christianity suit the needs of postmodernism, like say through art or something, instead of trying to make the art suit the needs of postmodernism, but instead of having the postmodernism suit the art, you know what I'm kind of getting at?
I right up until your last statement, I did. Instead of having
say a music piece, for example, instead of having postmodernism be affected in the meaning and the truth of the gospel with that same feeling that everyone else has, instead of pointing to just postmodernism as the answer, but to God instead. But I don't know, I think it would be important as Christians to understand what postmodernism is, because people feel it and it's afflicting them in the same ways that it's afflicting us, but we need to show a revelation of Jesus Christ instead of trying to take postmodernism, that feeling, and incorporate it into Christianity.
Okay. So I understand at least half of what you're saying is that you think it's a mistake to try to express Christianity in postmodern things. But were you also saying it would be okay to take the styles, the artistic styles of postmodernism, and give a non-postmodern message?
I'm just saying that in our culture, the people are afflicted by postmodernism. They feel the same way. You know, I feel my thoughts feel fragmented, like there's a lot of knowledge that I don't feel like I know, or a lot of things that the postmodernism is saying, you know, language is a barrier and all that, that people actually feel that, and that say in a sermon you use those feelings and understand what postmodernism is to better understand the people and where they're coming out of in order to drive the tooling.
Okay, so understand what their experience is and address the objective truth of the gospel to their experience, to their condition and their thing. Okay, good. Yeah.